The following program is funded by the National Endowment for the Arts and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting through NPR's Satellite Program Development Fund. Support for the distribution of this program is provided by National Public Radio member stations and the NPR Arts and Performance Fund. Contributors include the National Endowment for the Arts, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Burlington Northern Foundation. The Nature of Music series is produced by Garuda Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.
From Garuda Productions, The Nature of Music.
To me, the merchandising aspect is has become the thing instead of the content. Classical musicians will go on these entertainment shows. You can be sure Pavarotti shows up every 3 months on the Johnny Carson show for $400, even though he demands $100,000 or more for an appearance. But that's his way of keeping in front of the public eye.
I'm Lynn Farmer. This time on The Nature of Music, we're asking questions about music and commerce. Music is an enormous business, says composer John Cage on another of these programs. It is a business. The rapid commercialization of music in the 20th century has affected almost every aspect of it, for composers, for performers, and for listeners. On this program, rock musician Frank Zappa tells how he makes and sells his own records with a hotline, a computer, and good distributors. Amy Horowitz takes us to the bus stations of Israel, where a grassroots cassette industry outsells the major record labels. And what about classical music? Producer Jay Sachs of CBS Masterworks claims that if a wonderful new symphony by Mozart were discovered and put on record, no one would buy it. If anyone in the United States knows the record business, classical and popular, it's Mitch Miller, former head of Columbia Records' pop division. Miller says that a lot of people watch those television shows where the big recording stars like to appear.
And what it does, they say, well, if they're on television, therefore, they must be very special. And they are. But if someone is not on television and is very good, they don't put it this way, they listen with their eyes instead of their ears. Another good example is these so-called competitions. We can go back way back to Van Cliburn. Now, Van Cliburn was a wonderful young artist, but nobody knew who he was. He won the Leventritt in America, and he was going around. He was down to about two appearances for $500 a piece, two appearances a year. And he decided he's going off to Moscow, and he enters the Tchaikovsky competition and wins. Now, he was the same pianist 2 weeks before as the day he won. But suddenly, he has the imprimatur that he won a contest. So, and everyone says, well, therefore, he must be great. Well, if they listened to him before, they would have realized that he had great taste and great ability.
Van Cliburn, playing the Tchaikovsky Piano Concerto, recorded shortly after his triumphal return from Moscow in 1958. Incidentally, people who only know Mitch Miller from his Sing Along with Mitch show on television might be interested to know that Mitch was an oboist with the CBS Symphony in the 1930s and, at the request of conductor Leopold Stokowski in 1947, recorded the English horn solo in the Swan of Tuonela. Later, he was one of the most successful record producers in the history of pop records, with more than 175 hits to his credit. What is this record business really like? How does a record company choose what to put on the market?
This is a business. It's not subsidized. It's not supported by grants from government organizations. It's a business.
Jay Sachs is a classical record producer at CBS Records, one of the largest record companies in the Western world. Sachs says that in the classical record business, what's on a hit record is generally not classical at all.
It's usually a classical artist doing what we call crossover, such as, I would guess, someone like Luciano Pavarotti singing Neapolitan songs, or Placido Domingo doing an album with John Denver. This is the kind of stuff that lands up on the Billboard classical charts as a hit, and in fact translates into large sales. And one can argue, in fact, that these kinds of projects will allow and enable other less profitable projects to be done.
In the case of strictly classical records, according to Sachs, there's no question about what people will buy lots of.
The kind of stuff that will do best in terms of sales is invariably not undiscovered or recently discovered repertoire that one never heard before. It's usually not the case of, oh, that's a fantastic piece that nobody ever heard of, and now we finally have a recording of it. That kind of thing usually just lays there and doesn't sell at all, you know, maybe a couple of thousand. Records that do well and are considered really as classical music will be generally the more well-known pieces.
In Israel a few years ago, working-class immigrants couldn't find familiar music, and we don't mean Beethoven's Ninth, on major record labels. So a grassroots industry sprang up to sell them the music they wanted on cassette.
Hey, Rosita, varno eshet ha-gitara, shiri shara.
First of all, it's interesting to know that these cassettes outsell CBS Records within Israel. It's phenomenal. And the relationship per population to sales of these cassettes would be as if something sold 50 million copies here. You know, you're talking about a population of only 4 million people.
Amy Horowitz studied a phenomenon in Israel she calls the bus stop cassette industry.
When you approach the bus station here, first you pass streets and streets of little booths, kind of like a bazaar, kind of like a festive thing, and there's the blasting from different booths, different cassettes of music, all Middle Eastern, all very ornamented voices and ouds and kanuns and darbekas, and people bustling around and all different kinds of breads being sold. You understand that this is more than a bus station. It's a cultural center. There's something happening here.
So you go into one of the booths, says Horowitz. You see rows and rows of cassettes. Some are produced in studios, though they don't have the same commercial look as CBS or Herazi. Others contain old folk songs copied off in Kurdistan, Morocco, or Ethiopia, and have handwritten labels.
And some of them are some of the newer kings and queens of this cassette culture network, Chaim Moshe, Jackie McKayton, these folks who are maintaining much of the Middle Eastern sound, but there's also a kind of infusion of Mediterranean music, what I would call maybe Greek music, and then also utilizing some of the Western instruments. So the cassette culture, the bus stop phenomenon, was something that they developed. as their own network, as their own industry, their own forum. And it's very telling that it developed around the bus stations. Why? Many of these people are working, are the working class part of the society, so they would be more likely to be traveling by bus than have their own private cars.
In Israel, independent entrepreneurs of the bus stop cassette business cashed in on the musical needs of Israel's Sephardic immigrants. In America, when a large segment of music lovers became disenfranchised, a sharp-eyed entrepreneur stepped into that gap. Syndicator Al Ham brought out a show of golden oldies, now carried by more than 150 commercial radio stations.
What it does is bring back a whole part of their life that was turned off by the industry's constant attention to youth music and the youth syndrome. It would literally had been phased out for the last 20, 30 years. So it would be just like, oh, suppose you were brought up in the era of the Beatles, and all of a sudden, every, say, for the next 20 to 30 years, the Beatles music was actually thrown off of radio.
Gonna take a sentimental journey. Gonna set my heart at ease. Gonna make a sentimental journey to renew.
When we start off with the Music of Your Life station, we don't ask who your favorite artists are. We ask, what are your three favorite songs? And you'll find that those songs are the ones in that particular kind of music, which is not in the genre of rock and roll. It's quite different. And you'll find people, as we go on in time, such as your Linda Ronstedts, gradually picking up on this kind of music.
Upon a star, like dreamers do.
One philosophy of broadcasting says you should appeal to the widest possible audience, to many kinds of people. But Al Ham is successful in identifying a narrow segment of all the listeners, listeners who were passionate about a kind of music that was missing from their lives.
Certainly, you're getting the effect there because you are narrowcasting, and you're literally concerned with reaching that particular audience rather than trying to please everybody.
Earlier, CBS Records producer Jay Sachs said, it's a business. The tension between commerce and creativity defines the marketplace of music. Frank Zappa is a rock music composer and entrepreneur with an opinion about how recording artists are chosen.
Well, look at who's making the decisions as to what to sign, and look at what's at stake. The job of the guy who signs the artist and his perks. So he's not going to give that up. Their job, according to the director from the boss, is sign only those groups which will sell millions of units. I mean, nobody tells these guys, go out and get me the best music that there is. Get me the most interesting artists that are available. Get me something unique. Nobody ever told them that. They only said, get me hits.
Zappa says that if you're a composer or a performer making unusual music, your chances of getting a real record contract with a regular record company are not good.
But anybody can take a small ad in the right magazine saying that you have such and such a product for sale, and so long as you fulfill the deliveries on those products, you can keep yourself going by doing that.
So how does Frank Zappa keep himself going?
It's done with a computer and an office staff. We have a mail order business. And for those people in certain socially retarded sections of the United States and customers overseas know that if they write to a certain address that they can get any of the products that they want.
Along with a computer and an office staff, Zappa does it with a hotline.
Right, and call that number, and it'll put you in touch with the place where all the commodities are available, and they'll also give you information about what I'm doing. I mean, you get to talk to a human being if you call during office hours, but the number is 818-PUMPKIN.
And, of course, Zappa's record label is Barking Pumpkin. Zappa also takes control of the production of his records. He has his own recording studio, and he pays attention to merchandising details like the relative brightness and levels of songs on his records.
Well, just like the way merchandisers think about something called stacking. You know, what does a product look like when a number of units of it are piled next to each other on a supermarket shelf? What kind of a picture does it make?
Yo, cats. Yo, yo. Yo, chooch. Way to go.
When Zappa put together this Mothers of Prevention album, for example, he applied stacking principles to the sequence of the cuts.
The only EQ or level change that was added was on the song Yo Cats, which didn't seem to have as much top end as the other pieces on either side of it, and the level was a little bit low, and so that was modified. See, if a song is softer than the one before it, the psychology is it's less significant. If the song is duller than in terms of top end component than the one before, then it's not as happy. Sounds stupid, but it does work that way. And you understand?
Psychologist Hugo Kiesing specializes in the relationship between popular music and society. Kiesing says the visual impact of the cover, how an album is packaged, is important.
If you pick almost any album by Black Sabbath or Ozzy Osbourne, you may see crucifixes, you may see symbols which are alleged to represent demonic influences. Bats, there is a great deal of blood and gore on some of the album covers. And all of this is intended, I think, to make those albums visually not so much attractive, but to make them visually obvious to someone who is going through a bin with hundreds of records. These album covers stand out. If you walk into any record store today, you aren't only limited to the images that are in the record bins, but the walls will be plastered with huge facsimiles of the album cover. There will be mobiles. There will be all sorts of things to attract the eye. And in every record store right now, there will be a record playing at very high volume.
The concept of a hit and the way you determine what is a hit, says Kiesing, changed over the years. Until the First World War, it was sheet music sales. Then, through the Second World War, it was the number of times a song was performed by well-known singers in famous ballrooms and on radio and jukeboxes.
If one goes back to the pop charts of the 40s, one finds that a particular song might have had very popular versions by two or three or four artists. Well, one in particular, according to Billboard, there were three different versions of the song To Each His Own, which made the number one spot in 1946. Freddie Martin, the Ink Spots, and Eddie Howard each had versions that at one point were listed as number one.
A rose must remain with the sun and the rain, or its lovely promise won't come true. To each his own, to each his own, and my own is you.
If you remember the radio show, later television show, Your Hit Parade, the emphasis was on song, not artist. The radio show was sustained for many years by a fixed cast that would sing the top seven songs of each week. It's really not until the mid-50s that the commodity becomes the recorded version. And it's interesting because Your Hit Parade died at about the same time that the audience would no longer listen to Snooky Lansing singing a song made popular by Elvis Presley. The audience wanted the Presley version. They didn't care for the song as much as they cared for the recorded version of that particular song.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog.
Elvis Presley represented one version of the new black sound that was taking over. The house band and singers of Your Hit Parade were not flexible enough to keep up with the times. In the case of pop records, a successful producer has to anticipate the changing tastes and moods of the public, or get lucky.
And you must remember, timing has an awful lot to do with it, and that is, you can never predict the timing.
Mitch Miller says that a lot of hits happen purely by chance.
A recent example would be The First Time I Ever Saw Your Face, recorded by this wonderful singer in Washington. The first time I ever saw your face. She had it on an album, and then went completely unnoticed. And it was the third or fourth track, I guess, and about a couple of years later, Clint Eastwood made a film called Play Misty for Me, and he decided that he wanted that in the background. Well, as soon as the people heard that song being played in that film, they said, wow, you know, and it became a big hit and lasted number one for months.
The first time ever I saw your face, I thought the sun rose.
Roberta Flack got her start back in the late 1960s on a small label, Atlantic Records. Jerry Wexler is the co-founder of Atlantic, a jazz label for connoisseurs. He sold it in 1967, but his heart is still with the independents.
I've got the greatest admiration for labels like Alligator or Hooli, which is Chris Strachwitz's label out of San Francisco, the round of people up in Boston. I mean, you can say they're doing God's work, you know, because they are only doing music that they like. Now, that's a marvelous thing to be able to do and survive in a capitalist world, in a free economy, because that's how we started at Atlantic. We started doing music that we like, and, you know, we called it column A. But then a column B came along. I had to sign heavy metal rock and roll groups whose music I couldn't abide. Okay, but the reason being, I wanted to grow. I wanted the company to grow. We couldn't stick with Ray Charles and Solomon Burke and Bobby Short and Mabel Mercer. Either you go forward or you start spinning backwards.
Blow, ill wind, blow away. Let me rest today. You're blowing me no good.
The small record company may be doing God's work, as Wexler says, but that doesn't exempt them from the realities of a competitive marketplace.
An independent, you know, is subject to the first puff of wind that comes along, you know, and next thing is pleurisy, and you're out of business. I remember a record label back in the late 60s, was going very well with rhythm and blues, and the owner had a chance to sell, and he said, hell, he said, they only want to give me $4 million for my company. You know, and I said, grab it, you know. Well, he was out of business 2 years later, and he got nothing.
I'm in Mr. Pitiful. Baby, that's my name.
Pitiful situation that the heroic people who were putting this out are always on the edge, on the thin edge of extinction. And that's why I respect them so much, because I wasn't the hero. We did that kind of music, and I said, this ain't enough for me. I want my little crib in the Hamptons.
Wexler says that the independents have a role to play in the overall marketplace.
The role is to pour pure, fresh, limpid water into the big muddy sea. If you want to hear Zydeco music, if you want to hear Clifton Chenier, if you want to hear a Cajun waltz, you're sure as hell not going to hear it on any major labels. They can't bother with a record which may sell 1,000 copies.
Dewey Balfa is a Cajun musician from southwest Louisiana. His album called Souvenir is on the independent Swallow label and was nominated for a Grammy. Although Balfa played fine Cajun music, he had to have business smarts to succeed. He started out by going to see Floyd Swallow, a local record producer who specialized in Cajun music.
When I went to see him, you see, I wasn't a recording artist. but I wanted to start recording. And he said, well, there's no use for me to start recording somebody that hasn't got a name, because I can get any of 20 or so groups that has already has built up their names as recording artists of Cajun music. So I don't see any need for me to throw some money at you when you're not known other than, you know, in the very immediate area. So I think it was the fourth time that I went to see him that I kind of got my patient kind of ran out now. And I guess I wasn't very nice to him. I told him, I said, it's a pity that I got stuff that I want to put on record, but I'll have to do it with a company from New York. And I was referring to Folkways. And I said, here you are, you're in your backyard, and you won't even give it a try. So as I started to walk out, he called me back in, and he said, exactly what you're referring to. So I told him. So we went to the studio, and we did two songs and released the 45, and about a month after that, he wanted another one. Then another one, then he wanted an album.
L'hai mattino c'era mi, mostro nel mauvais nouvel. Mon papa, il est mort, il est grand après-midi.
If you're a Cajun artist, you know that you can't make a living at it. You can't make money. So, you know, see, some people that are Cajun fiddlers, but they rather play bluegrass, country, country western, than they do Cajun music. Because if they want to try to make a living at playing music, they got to get away from Cajun music. And I'm sort of like an old captain, you know. My ship may be old, but when it sinks, I'll sink with it.
If the natural tendency of the business world is to supply the familiar, will all creativity be excluded from the marketplace? Again, popular music specialist Hugo Kiesing.
The business pressure is to, in some ways, constrict the music, to make it more predictable, to make it safe. But as that constriction takes place, there is that raw energy which has characterized popular music for many, many years. And as the major labels become too conservative or so conservative that they can no longer accommodate new kinds of music, things will begin to bubble up at the fringes again. And I certainly hope that that process will continue, because to me, that's what keeps the music exciting.
Don't mess with my toot-toot. Don't mess with my toot-toot. Now you can have the other woman, but don't mess with my toot-toot.
This is The Nature of Music. You can get a free program guide and cassette tape information for The Nature of Music series by writing to The Nature of Music, NPR, Washington, D.C., 20036. Again, write to The Nature of Music, NPR, Washington, D.C., 20036. Our program on music and commerce is written and produced for Garuda Productions by Carl Signell and Deborah Jane Lamberton. John Widoff is the mix engineer and Michael Wilpers the research assistant. The executive producer for the series is Dr. Carl Signell. This series is funded by the National Endowment for the Arts and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting through NPR's Satellite Program Development Fund. I'm Lynn Farmer, and this is NPR, National Public Radio.